Judy Rebick supports Rabble because
Rabble's one of the very few spaces anywhere that you get a variety of views. All the new movements that emerged in Canada, whether it was Idle No More, the Maple Spring, the first place they appear is on Rabble.
Thanks, Judy. Just a few reasons to support Rabble.ca. Go to www.rabble.ca/donate.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Ears on the Earth, Rabble.ca at the World Social Forum. Well, it's day 4 of our broadcast from Montreal and day 3 of our show from the World Social Forum. So it has been quite a whirlwind week and amazing time. Lots and lots of things to record. Our podcast team has been out on the streets trying to bring all kinds of interesting sounds and interesting ideas to you. So I'm Victoria Fenner, the executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network, and you're listening to Ears on the Earth. And think one of the things that's difficult and challenging and really energizing at the same time is thinking about a theme for every show that we do, because we like to give you an idea about what the show is going to be about. But at an event like this, it's a grab bag of a whole bunch of stuff. So I'm thinking, what's today's show and what should it be about? So I was just at a discussion around this campfire, which is made of stumps and some red tissue paper crumpled up with some Christmas lights under it to make it look like it glows. So it was a really imaginative idea for a conversation pit. And we were talking about what do we need to do to create a new story. So I think the theme of today's show is going to be creating a new story. Well, one of the stories which needs retelling, because it's been a really, really disgraceful, sad and tragic story, are the story of our Indigenous people, not just here in North America, but around the world. But today, I'm going to be bringing you a talk that was at a discussion I was at yesterday, and it's called Indigenous People's Struggles and Resistance, Building Solidarity for Land, Self-Determination, and Justice. There are a number of amazing speakers, which I will be playing on Rabble in weeks to come. But right now, here is Tom Goldtooth, who is from the Indigenous Environmental Network, and he's an Indigenous rights leader, speaker, and film producer, and he's from Minnesota.
In our long history of organizing since 1990, that's when we were formed, we felt that in our critical analysis that we need to do something different, that a lot of the corporations, someone mentioned the role of the corporations, but also is the role of the colonial government as well, that allows the corporations to have the power that they have. It is a revolving door between corporations and government and NGOs. From my experience in participating in the United Nations, for an example, one of our mandates as Indigenous peoples coming together around the environment, which is defending the sacredness of our Mother Earth and Father Sky. Those two entities, Father Sky and Mother Earth, is part of the creation, the natural laws of the universe. And one of the mandates of that is to come together as a confederation, as an alliance, as a collective of Indigenous peoples, a voice of the youth and the elders. That's how we were formed. Milton Bourne with the Tooth is one of the founders from Alberta, from the Blood Nation. I think he took a bulldozer to Old Man Dam, the old man dam, was it? It was a dam issue back then. But part of the energy policy has been to flood Indigenous people's lands. As many of you know, our brother from James Bay region very often know our Fort Berthold people from North Dakota. It's always been this this colonized mentality, kind of like a predator, type of way of life that people brought with them from Europe. Somehow back in those early years of settlers coming to this, our part of the world, there was something about them that they somehow lost their connection to what we say is the sacredness to the to our Mother Earth. They didn't have that understanding. Some did, some of the farmers in North Dakota and Minnesota where I'm from. I'm Dakota, but they were Kantawan Dakota, the dwellers of the Sacred Lake. My mother is Southern Dene. I've been up to Northern Dene country of the Athabascan Chippewan First Nation where Tar Sands is. That's our northern relative. So I'm Dene and Dakota. So we have farmers who are descendants. Some of them carry some old tribal earth ways with them that they understood, but basically many had lost those old teachings of how to relate to Mother Earth. So years later, here we are as indigenous peoples trying to fight off the encroachment not only of colonization and the governmental structures that have never fully recognized our rights as indigenous peoples, have never fully recognized our self-determination to make our own decisions, our own sovereignty, to be able to recognize that we have jurisprudence over our territories. But does Canada recognize it? Never. Does United States recognize that? Never. So in the United States, land has always been the issue from the beginning, land, and who controls the land. That has been always the fundamental conflict that we have faced with colonizers coming, landing on the eastern shores. We have to look at the doctrines that were utilized in this colonization of our territories, and you may read about this called Doctrines of Discovery, how the governments of Europe and the church needed to work together. They needed to somehow legally, under international law, occupy a territory that was already occupied and with civilizations, with people that had song, that had spirituality, we had language. But somehow they had to create a tool, a doctrine of discovery, you could call it the papal bull, in a way that they redefine who we are as less than human. Less than human, that we were pagans. We were just these people that were uncivilized, running around naked in the land, that we're just, you know, lazy and we weren't using all the land. So they reclassified us as a tool of discovery. And that's why we have a movement of resistance to change these policies that have been integrated now in colonial law, Canada and United States. And I know that our presentation is very brief and we want to keep it open for dialogue, but I needed to start out with this principle, not a principle, really it's been implemented. We have indigenous people who have actually had an opportunity to finally meet with the Pope and the Pope's captains and the colonels. And they said, we're going to study this argument. They said, we already pulled back on the papal bull. We already pulled back, and we're not implementing those doctrines of discovery anymore. But we had to say, but Canada has implemented, now it's a foundation of the indigenous, of Indian rights, Indian law in the United States. That's factual. So we said, we have to change that. My other comment about indigenous resistance is our network. We were formed in 1990 when a lot of the waste companies, toxic waste companies, and also the nuclear energy, and they were looking for a place to store toxic and radioactive waste. this was going on in Canada, but not as large a degree it was happening in the United States. Where were they going to store this? They were trying to come to our territories, thinking that we're dumb, thinking that we're broke and we're living in poverty. So they're making these big, we call it nowadays benefit sharing. We have to be very cautious on these concepts of benefit sharing, because they said, we have monetary and financial benefits we can give you if you can store our nuclear waste in your land. Trust us, we have modern technologies. Don't worry about it. We have engineers, we have scientists, we can store it under the ground. Don't believe Tom Goldtooth and all these indigenous activists who say it's going to leak, it's going to contaminate the earth. So we're confronted with this mentality. White is right. One of the symptoms of colonization that I've studied throughout the world, Australia, the Adivasis from India, the Khoisan from South Africa, is the symptom of internalized oppression. Internalized oppression, to where we have internalized the way of the oppressor. So sometimes it's challenging to confront these contradictions of governance that's being promoted by Canada and United States, saying that they are heroes of human rights. They're saying that they are reducing their carbon footprint under this new minister, Trudeau. But we see business as usual. That's what we see. Are they going to cut back the production of greenhouse gases and other toxic releases in the tar sands? No. If you look at the figures, they're not cutting back. They're even still promoting the pipeline, the transportation infrastructure. So we see the contradictions, but they play numbers with us the same way they played numbers in the early years of colonization. So indigenous resistance, we had to organize ourselves as indigenous peoples, taking a lead from the youth, taking the lead from our elders. That's how our network was formed. And since 1990s, when we organized, we have effectively stopped a lot of toxic waste proposals that have come into our territories.
That was Tom Goldtooth from the Indigenous Environmental Network, and he was speaking at an event at the World Social Forum called Indigenous People Struggles and Resistance, Building Solidarity for Land, Self-Determination, and Justice.
Well, all week I have been working at the wonderful media center known as The Place to Be at the World Social Forum, and it's just a fabulous place. There's everything we need. There is it's a great atmosphere with creative things like a news tree and a bonfire, and not a real bonfire, of course, but anyway, kind of an art installation. And there's also beer taps, which actually I haven't taken advantage of yet, but anyway, who knows? The day is young. So I didn't know really too much about this place other than how nice it was that this was set up for us. And so now I'm here with the organizers of Place to Be, and I find out that Place to Be isn't just a place here at the World Social Forum. How would you describe it? Can you tell me who you are and what is Place to Be?
Yes, of course. I'd be very happy to do it. Place to Be was born during COP21. As a place too. So it was a place in Paris for this very important conference on climate, where we wanted to offer a headquarter to what we call narrators, the people who are building the story, and what we called at the time the climate story, but which is the story of transition in general, and of cooperation. And this all headquarters was a very good tool to have people met together, discover they had common interests, and that they could have many projects scaled up by working together. So it was quite a success. We had around 15,000 people gathering in this place in Paris, but with also in other sites in France, in regions. And following the end of COP21, many people asked us, so the team, the French team at the time, what was next, and asking, just verifying that Place2Be wasn't over. So Place2Be, which was only a site, a place at the time for COP21, transformed itself as an international organization, non-profit. It's a French association based in Paris, the one I'm working for, with connections to other people around the world. And for example, a very good example at the time, the people here in Montreal who are managing the Place2Be sites during World Social Forum, meaning Julie, Blandine, and Bruno.
So then, if I get this right, then what happened was you're a Paris organization set up for the climate change conference in Paris, right? And how did you then, I mean, we're a long way from Paris. So they just called and said, hey, can you set this up in Montreal for us? Is that how it worked?
Yeah, well, that's the wonderful thing when you are able to invite so many people to gather in one place. The fact that you have thousands of people who at the time in Paris were coming from more than 70 countries. And when they came back home, some of them, and the first ones were in fact Canadians, saying, well, we liked the place and we have another event coming home, which is the World Social Forum, and we would really be happy to inspire ourselves, and we have of course many other ideas, so maybe we could do our own Place2Be there. And our answer was, that's the spirit of it. We are an organization which wants to spread the fact that Place2Be can be done by anyone, and you can set your own Place2Be everywhere.
So it's a media center that can happen anywhere.
Exactly.
Wonderful. And now, can you introduce yourself and tell me what your role in this whole thing is?
My role in English? Yeah? Okay. I'm a director of Place2Be.
And your name is?
My name is Nicolas Bienvenu. No. I work for the team for the development strategy of the Place2Be in different territory, in international and national territory. The concept the project doing in the future. It's my objective. There are a lot of places in the world, and there are a lot of events. It's important to speak differently of the society subject, and I try to help this movement like this.
So then, have you been to anywhere else other than Paris and now Montreal? Are there other places where you've set up Place2Be?
Yeah, well, we have had 6 very busy months in France because we had to transform what was a temporary event into a permanent organization. So first, we took our marks in France. So we have had events in other cities of France, like in Bordeaux, and several, of course, again in Paris. And here we were very happy because it was our first new international event, because those kind of things take a long time to organize. If I take the example of the French event of Place2Be, it was a 2 years in the making event. This time they were very, very fast because they were able to do it in 8 months. And we are also working to be, for example, in Morocco in November for COP22. And we have had also other proposals to be, for example, in the US or in Germany or in London. But I think it will be next year because it's difficult. We are a very small organization with only 4 or 5 people working at the same time in Paris, and here they have also a small team of 3 person in the core team, so we have to choose our projects very carefully. And we are not only doing events, we are also doing communication studies, and also working on the network, on the digital, on our website. So at the same time we have to really to choose what we can do. For example, we are often saying that if we had only been doing this Canadian event this year, it would have already been a very great year. So we are doing many other things, but if we can travel to 2 or 3 countries per year, it's already a very good thing for us.
Well, thank you very much for coming here and setting this up. It is such a wonderful atmosphere. I mean, first of all, the location is great, but the location doesn't make for a great event alone. But it's like you have so many imaginative things. And it's I look around and I just get inspired by just how well you've put it together. So thank you for coming to Canada. And we hope to see you in another country at
a
World Social Forum.
I hope. I'm sure.
That was Sami Cheikh Moussa, and he's one of the people who set up Place to Be here in Montreal, and Nicolas Bienvenu, who is the Director General. Well, it's time for a break to go outside of the media center in just a couple of minutes. And so this coming up next is an interview which is done by one of our team members, Campbell McClintock. And it's from a workshop that he went to called Another Economy is Possible, Building the Solidarity Economy in the U.S. And the person he's talking to is Julie Mathai. And the panel was a fabulous interactive conversation about the solidarity economy and the practical everyday ways in which we can subvert capitalism. Campbell interviewed Julie Mathai, and she's professor of economics at Wellesley College, and she's a self-proclaimed Marxist, feminist, anti-racist, ecological economist. And so here now is Campbell McClintock and Julie Mathai.
So what exactly is the solidarity economy?
Well, it's an emergent set of values, practices, and institutions that exists in market economies now all over the world alongside of capitalist institutions. And it's based in the values of solidarity and compassion, caring, equity in all dimensions, democracy, real democracy, sustainability, and diversity.
And you discuss a number of ways in which the average person can participate in the solidarity economy and shift away from a capitalist one. What are some of the ways that we can apply that in our everyday lives?
Well, I think the most important way is just taking your values, which most people have, pretty progressive values about caring for others and caring for the environment, and taking them into your economic life. When you're a consumer, look at how the good was made. Think about fair trade buying. Think about your footprint on the earth. Think about recycling and having just sufficiency and not maximizing consumption. If you're a worker, think about the content of your work. Try to do something that helps people. Try to work for a business that has values you believe in, or if you work in a destructive corporation, be a whistleblower or leak information about the bad things they're doing, or start your own worker co-op or your own business that might have, like, a social enterprise, we call it. People are starting businesses with the goal of making a positive contribution. So that's work and consumption in your those are some main ones, I would say.
Right. How do you think the WSF functions as a platform to discuss the solidarity economy, and what do you think the relationship is between your organization and the other ones here?
Well, interesting question, because actually the solidarity economy really emerged along with the World Social Forum movement, and the Social Forum movement started in Latin America, especially in Brazil, and people had this idea of the solidarity economy, and they'd observed it, but they actually... The movement said to the first World Social Forum, it said, you should buy your things from worker co-ops, you should buy things from that are sourced in a solidaritous way. And because the forums were so big, there were like 100,000 people, it was like a jump starter for a lot of co-ops, literally, for that were part of the solidarity economy. And they've always had programming at all the World Social Forums about the solidarity economy. That's how I found out about it at a World Social Forum. So because the World Social Forum brings together groups from all over the world that are under the banner Another World is Possible and Another Economy is Possible, the solidarity economy is the framework that helps understand the new possible solidaritas economy.
You also noted you've been a democratic socialist since the 70s. How do you feel that movement and the solidarity economy movement have evolved over time, and what progress are they making?
Well, the solidarity economy movement has really emerged after the 70s. I mean, I was a 60s radical. I've been a socialist my whole life. Obviously, with Bernie Sanders, he's brought democratic socialism into the limelight in the U.S. and almost won the Democratic nomination. So I think the youth in our country are just much more open to knowing that we need a new economy and that people have basic economic human rights that need to be respected, which was what he talked about. The solidarity economy movement is it's a new way of looking at a new system instead of like a revolution that would turn into a socialist or communist country and have the state take power over the economy. It's much more an organic development within markets alongside of capitalism that we already see happening. So it's more gradual, and I think we will need changes in state power, and the state is going to have to change policies and rules. And there's a conference in Montreal in September that's all focused on social solidarity economy policies, because there's many governments now around the world that are starting to implement them. It's even in the Constitution. The solidarity economy is in the Constitution of Ecuador, for example. And there's countries that have ministers of solidarity economy. Brazil and France have ministries of solidarity economy. So as the concept and the framework and these new practices are really developing. The UN even has some kind of investigative committee on it. The International Labor Organization has a training program every year around the solidarity economy. So it's evolved a lot.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Julie.
You're welcome.
And that was Julie Mathai, who is professor of economics at Wellesley College. And she spoke to Campbell McClintock on her talk, which she did at the World Social Forum, which was called Another Economy is Possible, Building the Solidarity Economy in the U.S. Okay, well, I've changed my mind here. I told you that I was going to be solo on the show today because my team was out busily gathering material. Well, they just came in and said that they found the greatest clip of the week. So here is Campbell and Sophia telling us what makes this next clip so great.
Campbell and I were wandering around the Espace Jeunesse this afternoon, which is a space at Place des Arts for pretty much everyone to congregate who's involved in the World Social Forum. And we were talking to people about why they were in Montreal this week. And we spoke with a young woman, she's 14 years old, who actually didn't even know that World Social Forum was going on, but had some very articulate, very powerful things to say about the change she wants to see in the world. I'll let you hear it for yourself. So what's your name?
Meshama.
And where are you from, Meshama?
I'm from Montreal. My parents are Jamaican and Ethiopian.
Cool. And so you're walking by the youth space, the Espace Jeunesse at the World Social Forum, which is a place where young people are talking about change in the world and things they care about. Is there anything in particular that you think you need to see in the world in the future to make it a better place?
Probably a change in the system as it is now, or even a whole new system, because our whole system is based on white supremacy, and so it was never actually broken, it was just really not made for us. And for there to be change and for there to be a better world for everyone, there needs to be building of a new system and not the fixing of one that was never actually broken. I think that would probably be the biggest thing.
And have you been involved in any movements here in Montreal or conversations with people about how to do that?
I was on the CBC series Talk on Race with my mom and her family. And I've also attended Black Lives Matter protests and gone to discussions. It's like trying to, because I'm only 14, so I'm still trying to kind of get into it and learn more before I actually really do a big thing.
That's awesome. Well, thanks so much for talking with us. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, you're right. That was really, really worth hearing. So thanks for rushing in with your last minute clip to say, quick, you can't put the show to bed yet. We got to add this. That's what I love about working with you guys. So this is indeed the end of the show for Thursday. Victoria Fenner for Ears on the Earth and the rest of our podcast team. And we will be back tomorrow again with all the stuff that I promised you a little earlier. Talk to you tomorrow. Ears on the Earth is a production of Ravel.ca.